Have you ever looked at the world and thought that there's something wrong? Have you ever looked at the world and seen what's going on in Eastern Europe, even now? Powerful nations are oppressing those who are weak. In the Middle East, violent men are subjugating and sometimes even killing any who disagree with them. In Africa, corruption and greed are causing millions to suffer. In Europe, there's an incredibly strong feeling, a growing feeling, that politicians and bankers and those in power are acting only in their own interests, whilst ordinary people pay the price. In North America, hate-filled individuals are going on killing sprees, and it seems that nobody even wants to stop them. Those are the problems, some of the problems that we see when we look around the world. What happens when we look closer to home here in Clydach? Well, it's the same things, isn't it? But obviously on a smaller scale. We're not immune from these global problems. Maybe your car or your garden shed is broken into. Do you expect the criminals to be found? Or do you expect them to get away with it? They'll probably get away with it, won't they? Maybe you've made the mistake of going into town on a Friday or a Saturday night. And what do you expect? Well, you're very likely to see drunkenness and violence, spoiling it for those who simply want a quiet night out with their friends. You know, don't you, that there are benefit cheats who exaggerate the problems or even lie to get more money from the state than they deserve, whilst honest people end up with less. And you know that with all of these problems, and there are many, many more, with all of these problems, something needs to be done. And that's what the politicians always promise, isn't it? But whatever the big problems of the day are, that the politicians will line up and they'll tell us to vote for them because they'll solve the problem. Maybe the problem is to do with the deficits. It's to do with Britain running out of money. And they've got their different ideas. But they all tell you that they're the ones who will solve the problems. They'll share the money out more equitably. They'll generate more money for everybody. Maybe the problems the politician tells us are to do with immigration. And they say we're the ones who will solve the problems. They've got their different ideas of how to go about it. But they're the ones who will solve the problems. Perhaps the problem is crime or social disorder. We're the ones who will solve the problems. Perhaps the problems are to do with family and relationships. Even then the politicians say, we're the ones who will solve the problems. And what happens? They tinker around at the edges. They make little changes. And some things get better and some things get worse. And then 4 or 5 years later, we go through the same cycle again with slightly different problems. And the same things happened. It doesn't matter whether it's the Tories or the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats who are in charge or a mix of all of them. It's the same thing again and again and again. Something needs to be done. And history repeats itself, doesn't it? So the struggles that we have on a small scale, the struggles that the Greeks are having on a bigger scale, or the Ukrainians are having, or those in northern Iraq are having, they're the same problems that they were having in Isaiah's day back in 700 BC or so. They're the same problems. Because human beings are the same in every generation. It's the same problems. And if you were to read the first 39 chapters of the book of Isaiah, we're not going to do that now, don't worry. But if you were to read them, you'll realise as you go through those chapters that it's very much about the problems and the injustices that were in the world in Isaiah's day. So for example, in chapter 3 and verse 15, God asks this to the people. He says, what do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor? It's an incredibly graphic description, isn't it? Of those who are wealthy and well off, taking advantage of those who are poor. And there are many people who would say, that's exactly the problem that we've got today. That's the problem that the bankers have caused, or the big businesses have caused, or whoever it is. Now, I'm not commenting now on whether that view is completely right today. Maybe it needs to be nuanced a little bit. But you understand, it's the same issue that people are complaining about now, that God was complaining about in Isaiah's day, that the rich were taking advantage of the poor. In chapter 1, verse 23, he condemns them for not defending the cause of the fatherless or the widow. He says that everybody loves bribes and that there's no justice around. He condemns the people for these things. So what's going to happen for this injustice? What's going to happen because of the violence? What's going to happen because people are taking advantage of those who are poor? What's going to happen because of that? Well, God says judgment is going to come as a consequence. That's what God is going to do. And ultimately, this judgment builds up through Isaiah chapters 1 to 39, and it kind of reaches its peak in chapter 39, the chapter before the one that we read. So at the very end of chapter 39, we read that God says in verse 6 of chapter 39 of Isaiah on page 638, he's talking now to Hezekiah. Hezekiah is the king of Israel, and he speaks to him, and he says, king of Judah rather, and he says, the days are coming when all that is in your house and whatever your fathers have accumulated until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left. Do you see what he's saying? This is the precursor of what we were looking at with Haggai over the last few months. Here's this prophecy and here's what God is saying. Look, the Babylonians are going to come. They're going to come and invade your nation and they're going to carry off the people. And they're going to carry off all the valuables and take them into Babylon. And Hezekiah is even told, verse 7, they shall take away some of your sons who will descend from you. And you will beget and they shall become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. The royal family themselves are going to be carted away. That's what God is going to do. He's going to bring judgment on the people. He's going to take away their sovereignty. He's going to take away their freedoms. He's going to take away the good things that they've stored up for themselves through wrong motives. He's going to take it all away and they're all going to be carried off into captivity in Babylon. Judgment is going to come. And Hezekiah has an incredible response to this word of judgment. You can see it in chapter 39 and verse 8. Having been told that he's going to be defeated, that he's going to lose his kingship, that his children and his grandchildren are going to be in captivity, his response, verse 8, is the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good. That's what he says. It's good. So why is this good? How can this be good for this captivity, this judgment to come? How on earth can this judgment be good? And it's not as if Hezekiah is thinking, great, I'm really glad God is going to judge everybody else because they've really been getting me down. Do you sometimes think that? You think about these people, the things that we've been describing, the people who cheat, the people who lie, the people who perpetrate violence, the people who extort the poor. I really hope God will judge them and I'll be really glad if God comes and judges them. Do you think that sometimes? Well, Hezekiah wasn't thinking that because he knew that when judgment came, it would fall on all of them. He knew that nobody was exempt. He wasn't pointing his finger merely and saying, I'm glad that judgment will come on them. He was saying much more generally, I know that when judgment falls, it will fall on all of us, including on me. But I'm still glad that that judgment is coming. The word that you have spoken is good. It's an incredible thought, isn't it? To be glad that this judgment from God is coming where he's going to bring an end to all of this. That's what he says. Look at the end of verse 8. Here's the reason he gives of why he's glad that this judgment is coming. Isaiah 39 verse 8 at the end. At least there will be peace and truth in my days. Isn't that incredible? At least there will be peace and truth in my days. Well, part of what he's saying here is that, well, this judgment that you've promised is in the future. It's not going to come right on me just now. There's going to be a little bit of time of peace and judgment, and I can be glad of that. I can make the most of that. At least there will be something good in my days. At least, God, you're not going to do it now. At least you're not going to do it right now. So he's glad, in other words, that God is patient. that God is not bringing this down immediately. It needs to happen. It needs to happen. But he's glad for the little bit of time that there is before the judgment comes. And that's really what the lesson, one of the lessons that we need to learn from this, is that God in his patience and in his mercy have given us a time before this judgment comes. And we need to be glad of that. We need to make the most of that. We need to be people who stand for peace and truth in our day. That's partly what's being said here. But if I'm to be honest, Hezekiah hasn't really understood. How could he? Hasn't really grasped what God is up to. He's still seeing things in the short term rather than in the long term. And what happens in the book of Isaiah is when we get to chapter 40, the whole tenor and nature of the book begins to change, and we begin, as it were, a new section. And the contrast between the end of chapter 39 and the beginning of chapter 40 is incredible. Because chapter 40 begins, "Comfort, yes, comfort my people." Hezekiah hasn't really understood this fully. But for those who are going to experience this judgment that's coming from God, they're going to need comfort. So what happens in Isaiah chapter 40 is that God says what it's going to be like in the coming days. "I'm going to comfort my people. Yes, there's judgment coming." That's chapter 39. "But I'm going to speak comfort to my people. Comfort Jerusalem. I'm going to cry out to Jerusalem." What am I going to cry? It's written in the present tense, but it's a prophecy about what's going to happen in the future. "That her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she's received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins." That's the message. That's what's going to happen. This is what God wants to say to the people before any of this comes. He wants them to know that actually there's a pardon that's possible. Yes, I'm going to bring judgment. Yes, I must bring judgment. I must bring an end to this. But there is a possibility of pardon. Isn't that wonderfully glorious and kind and gracious of God that before the judgment comes, he lets them know that there is going to be a pardon that's possible at the end of this? That's the message. So what does Isaiah say? What is this message about? What is this comfort? It's great that God says, I want to preach comfort to you. But the question's got to be, well, what is the comfort, Lord? What are you going to comfort us with? And here's the first thing is comforting to the people. Here's the first thing. If you're taking notes, this is the first proper heading, really. The king is coming back. The king is coming back. Or from Hezekiah's perspective, simply, the king is coming. The king is coming. Look at what is said. Verse 3 of Isaiah 40. Here's where to find out where this comfort is coming from. So there's a voice of one crying in the wilderness. And what does the voice say? "Prepare the way of the Lord. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill brought low. The crooked places shall be made straight and the rough places smooth." Here's the picture that Isaiah is painting here through his prophecy, that the people would be very aware of this. You can imagine in 700 or so BC, there was no tarmac roads, there was no M4. There were dirt tracks that were everywhere. And many of those dirt tracks, you couldn't get a cart down. You couldn't transport with your oxen or your donkeys or whatever it might be. They were just narrow little shepherd's trails. That's all that most of the paths and the roads were. So what would happen? Well, one day the king would say, "I need to go and visit such and such a city." Maybe he had to judge that city. Maybe he was going into battle, but for whatever reason, he was passing through, and this was the route that he was going to take. And of course, the king would be in his chariot, or he would be on some other kind of transport. He's not going to walk along a dusty road like everybody else is. So he's going to need a road. And if the road isn't there, and it probably isn't, then one needs to be built. And this is exactly what used to happen in the 8th century BC. That a messenger would be sent ahead in the king's name. And the messenger would come to a village and he'd say to the village, "Look, the king is coming through." And the villagers would all have to get together and to build a road for the king to travel on. And they'd have to fill in the potholes, as it were, and they'd have to level off the little humps and the divots and so on, so that the king would be able to pass through on this road. and the people would have to build that. And the messenger would come through the desert to tell them. That's the picture that Isaiah is bringing to mind here. But there's something very different about this picture to the normal picture, isn't it? There's something different about this to the way that it normally works. Because as we look at this, we see that every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill brought low, the crooked places shall be made straight, and the rough places smooth. This is no ordinary road that's being built. Maybe some of you have been watching the Tour de France. And particularly, was it a couple of days ago, they had that incredible mountain pass. Did you see the photos of the path that was snaking its way up the mountain? I don't know how many kind of 180 degree bends there were as it went up the mountain, and these cyclists were cycling up this incredible hill. Well, an amazing feat of engineering even to build that road with all those winding paths to get up and over the hill. An incredible feat of engineering. And that's not an 8th century BC feat of engineering. That's a relatively modern feat of engineering. But what is being said here? That there'll be a zigzag path that'll be going up the hills? Not at all. This is a highway. The valleys should be lifted up. The mountains brought low. The crooked places made straight. God's going to bulldoze straight through the mountain. That's the message here. Straight through the mountain. And we kind of used to that a little bit, aren't we? When we go up to Patolbert, we see there's a little bit of the mountain that's been blasted away. Only a little bit of it, but a little bit. We're kind of used to that. But 8th century BC? Incredible power that's being described here. Unimaginable power. As far as they were concerned, no human being could possibly do this. Even now, with all the engineering that we have, we wouldn't go to this extent. But that's what's going to happen. Prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. That's what's coming. Why? Well, because the King is coming. That's the point. God is coming. It's a highway for our God. So what does this represent? What's this to remind us of? Well, the King here is a one who's in great power, isn't he? If you can send a messenger into the desert and get all the villages and the townspeople to create a road, what great power and authority that you would have. And this picture of the Lord coming in such a way and building such a road is to remind us of the great power and authority that the Lord has to do such a thing. Nobody else could do this but him. He is the one of supreme power. He's the one of supreme authority. This is God. But he's saying more than that. Also, what used to happen with these roads when they built them in the 8th century, the king, he would be the one and he would travel down the road first. But of course, having done so, the road would be there, wouldn't it? For future generations, that road would remain. He was the trailblazer, as it were. He was the first one who traveled in that way. He was the one who made it possible. But now he's made it possible, many, many thousands more will be able to follow and also travel in that down that road. And new trade routes would be opened up and new opportunities would now be available to people because the king had made it possible. He'd blazed the trail. And so we're getting this message about God as well. That he's making this building, this permanent road. What he's doing here is going to last. He's not merely finding a way where he can get himself over the mountain, but he's blasting the mountain apart. He's creating that gap that everybody, that highway that everybody will be able to travel down. That's what the king is doing. And how is he doing it? He's doing it in response to the iniquity. He's doing it in response to the warfare. And the whole world will see it, verse 5 tells us. The glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. So what's this highway? What is it? Where's it come from? Where does it go? Can you see the picture? This is not a highway of somebody here on earth who's going to be building a route across a desert. This is much more than that. The picture is of God coming from heaven to earth. That's the picture. Of building the highway from heaven to earth. That's what he's doing. That's where he's coming, and he's going to arrive in earth, as it were, and all eyes will see him, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. That's the picture. God coming from heaven, coming from outside, to fix the problems of the earth. That's the point. Hezekiah couldn't fix the problems. Nebuchadnezzar and the other kings of their day, they couldn't fix the problems. The politicians of our day can't fix the problems. You can't fix the problems. I can't fix the problems. What do we need? We need a king from outside who will come and will fix these problems. That's what we need. We won't solve the injustice otherwise. We won't solve the problem of wickedness and sin and the nature of men's hearts. We need a king to come from outside. That's what we need. And that's what Isaiah promised here in chapter 40. The king would come. Well, what's this king like? What's the king like? Well, that leads us on to the second point that I want to share with you from these verses. This is a king like no other. A king like no other. Look at what we said, sort of verse 6 onwards or so. He tells us, first of all, verses 6 through to 8, what a human being's like. Flesh, in other words. That's you and me. Well, we're like grass. It's why these verses are read at funerals. It's talking about our mortality. The grass withers, the flower fades. Why? Because the breath of the Lord blows on it. So here's this picture. Here's man in all of its strength. The proud. The ones who think that they're in charge. The ones who think that they're kings of their own little domains. These people like you and me, we might not think that we're the king of Babylon, or we might not think that we're the king of Israel, or the king of Judah, or wherever it is, but we quite often think we're the king of our little domain, don't we? The king of our little house, the king of our little area in work, the king of our own lives. We think that. We're the king of our own domain, and there we are. But actually, all it needs is a breath from God. The breath of the Lord blows on it, verse 7. And the grass withers and the flower fades. So again, the picture here is of a dry wind blowing across the wilderness and the desert and coming and scorching the grass and everything dying. In a moment. And human lives and human frailty are like that. We're just grass. We have our 80 years and just grass. We're mortal. And of course we're weak, therefore. We're limited. That's why we can't solve the problems. We can't do anything about it. But the point is, God is not like that. God is not like that. That's what we're like. But it's not what God is like. So, for example, verses 12 through to verse 20 tells us about the incredible power of God. He's like no other. So we're thinking of God now, verse 12. Who has measured the water in the hollow of his hand? So the picture now is of God up there in the heavens. And he's holding the world itself in his hand. Well, how much water does God hold in his hand? It's unmeasurable. But God has measured heaven with a span. You and I can't do that. The scientists, they give their estimates as to how big the universe is. But they're only estimates. They've got no clue at all. But God knows. How much dust is on the earth? Well, we could do our estimates. They'd be wildly out. But God knows every grain. He knows what the mountains weigh. Do you know what Gethlion a mountain weighs? Not a clue. God knows. And Everest too. You see, God knows all these things. And the point is, as he knows, verse 14, it's not because somebody else has told him. You see, even if you and I were clever enough to somehow use all of the combined knowledge that there was in the world of geology and physics and everything else to make a reasonably good guess about how much Gethlion and mountain weighed, even if we were able to do that, we wouldn't have worked it out on our own, would we? But we would be using the knowledge that had come from other people. We'd have been looking at scientists in the past and the experiments that they'd done and the things that they'd found out. And there'd be hundreds or thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of people who'd contributed to the scientific knowledge in all these different ways to build it up so that we could do that last little bit and find out the secret to the puzzle. But that's not how God knows. He doesn't know because he's learned from somebody else. Verse 14, with whom did he take counsel? Who did he talk to? Who was his teacher? Who taught him about justice and knowledge and understanding? And the answer's obvious. Nobody. He's not the receiver of knowledge. He's the source of knowledge. He's not the receiver of power. He's the source of power. He's like no other. And that's why, verse 15, the nations therefore are as a drop in a bucket. They're counted as small dust on the scales. This nation of Judah, the nation of Babylon, the empire of Babylon, they think so much of themselves. But look, just as from God's perspective, just a little bit of dust on the scales. You use scales, I'm sure, don't you? Maybe you're doing some cooking. Maybe you're posting a letter and you put your flour or your parcel on the scales. Do you give the scales a good scrub, first of all, to make sure there's no little bit of dust that is going to spoil the weight and give you the wrong amount? You don't care about that, do you? What does it matter if there's a couple of specks of dust on the scales? And God is saying, look, that's what it's like with these nations. They're just little specks of dust. They don't really change anything, not in the grand scheme of things. We think we're so important. We think we're so powerful and mighty. But we're just dust and scales. That's all we are. So we can't liken God to anything or anyone, verse 18. This is the mistake that so many people make. They say that God is like something else. Sometimes they build an idol. That's what Isaiah's talking about here. And God is like a man, but bigger and stronger. Or God is like an ox or a bear or whatever it might be. They build their gods. And we do the same in our own day. We think of God through our human eyes. But we can't do that. If we start to compare God with other things, then we never do him justice, because he's not like anything else. He is utterly unique. You can't liken him to anyone else. Don't you know this? That's what Isaiah asks in verse 21. Haven't you always been told this? He sits above the circle of the earth. We're just like grasshoppers. We've got the benefit of those satellite pictures, haven't we? We know a tiny little bit of what it might look like from a heavenly perspective. Just grasshoppers. That's what we're like compared to God. He is not like us. He is like no other. Incredibly powerful. All-knowing. He is not like us. And this is the God who is coming to earth. That's Isaiah's message. This is the God who's going to blow up the mountains and build the highway. And Route 1, coming to meet with a people who are unjust, who are wicked, who extort the poor, who take advantage, who get drunk, who lie, and who cheat. Route 1, I'm coming for you, says God. So how is the king going to come? I don't know if you noticed, but we skipped a few verses. Did you notice we skipped 10 and 11? Here's how he's going to come. He's going to come, verse 10, with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. His work is before him. That conjures up quite a picture, doesn't it? The arm of God is often used as a symbol of the strength of God. We think of it now, don't we? If somebody wants to prove how strong they are, I can't do it. But they pump up their muscles, don't they? That's how strong I am. It's my arm signifies that. Popeye, you might remember. But that's how we do it. How strong are you? That's the symbol that we use. And that's what the arm of God represents here. His strength, his might, his power. He's coming in power. That's the message to the people. I'm coming in power with a strong arm, a strong hand. And I'm coming to rule because I'm the king. Incredible picture. But then look at verse 11. The picture changes. What's he going to use his strength for? He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them into his bosom and gently lead those who are with young. When I was a teenager, there was a very popular photograph that was popular with girls. I couldn't see the point of it, but lots of girls liked it. Maybe it's still around today. Maybe some of you can remember it. It was a black and white photograph of a man wearing a pair of jeans but with no shirt and with rippling muscles. You see the sort of thing even now. But what was different about this photograph, and what I think particularly lots of the girls liked, was that this heavy duty muscle bound man was cradling a little baby in his arms. And it symbolized, forgive the apparent sexism, but I think what it was symbolizing here was what many women and girls wanted. Somebody who was strong to care for them. Somebody who was strong to care for them. And we often make the mistake, don't we, of associating care with weakness. And strength with violence. But this picture brought them both together, and it captured people's imaginations. And in a much greater and better way, that's what God is doing here. Strong enough to care and to provide and gently lead those who are with young. God, you see, knows our needs. He knows that some will need more than others. He knows that some will need to be carried. He knows that some will need to be led. He knows that some will need to be fed. And that's what he's going to do. That's what he's going to use his strength and his power for. This is a king like no other. This is a king who is glorious in his strength and his majesty. And yet a king who is coming in love. A king who is coming in compassion. A king who is coming in this incredible way. This is the king who's coming, says Isaiah. Well, finally, this is a great king, a king who is coming, a king who is like no other. Finally, now from verse 28 to the end, this is a king who will share his power and glory. He will share his power and glory. We can see it, can't we, in these verses. He says, verse 29, for example, he gives power to the weak. We've just been told about his great power. What's he going to do with that power? He's going to share it. He's going to give it. That's what he's going to do. You can see those who have no might, he increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. All this human strength, this virility, those who you would look to as the ones who would have the strength and the power. It's usually the young men, isn't it? They're the ones who go into battle. They're the ones who fight. They're the ones who are the athletes. They'll be weary. They'll lose, they'll faint, they'll fall. But not God. Actually, that's not what he says. He doesn't say the youths, the humans will fall, but God will stand. He doesn't say that, does he? He says those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. And if we're waiting on God, that's you and me. And God shares his power and he shares his strength with his people. That's the point. And that's what he's doing. He shares even his glory with his people. And those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength and mount up with wings like eagles and run and not be weary and walk and not faint. In other words, they'll keep going. They'll keep going. Where are they running and walking and fly into these people? What's the picture of here? What's the picture? Well, remember where we began. Where did we begin? We began with a highway, didn't we? God was building a highway. Where was the highway going? From heaven to earth. What was the point of the highway? So that God could come to earth from the outside and fix the problems that we've got. And what is God going to then do? He's then going to share his glory and his strength with his people, with those, in other words, who wait on him. And what will they be able to do? Well, just like they could do in the ancient days. Once the king had built the road, then the others could follow. And that's what's going to happen. God, in other words, is going to come from heaven to earth. He's going to make this way possible. He's going to build this road. And what's going to happen then? That those who wait on the Lord, they're going to be able to fly and run and walk. Where? Well, along the highway, of course. The highway to heaven. They'll return with him. That's the message. It's a highway for God, but he shares that with his people. He gives the route. And of course, we know, don't we? We know because of the Messiah. And we know because of what the Gospels teach us, that this is talking about the Lord Jesus Christ coming from heaven to earth to make that way. That's what he did. Somebody from the outside who has come into earth to fix those problems of injustice, to fix those problems of sin and of wickedness, to do it. And as God was doing that, he was coming with great power, but also with great love and great compassion. And this is a wonderful message, isn't it, that we're now able to remind ourselves of and to share with others. And many of you are on that road, as it were, aren't you? On that road, you've met, as it were, with God Himself. You've waited on Him, and you've had His strength. And because you've had His strength, you're able, as it were, to begin that journey to glory and to home. And we don't know quite how long it will take us to get there, do we? But many of you here this morning, I know, are on that road. And you're glad to be on it. You're glad to be on it. But maybe some of you here this morning are not yet on that road. Maybe some of you are not yet on that road to heaven, as it were. You've not yet met with God in this powerful way. You're not yet, what's the expression, waiting on the Lord, verse 31. What does it mean to wait on the Lord? Well, it means, firstly, it means obedience. It means obedience. You think of ladies in waiting. What do ladies in waiting do? Well, they're servants, effectively, aren't they? They're waiting to be told what to do so that they can obey the instructions from the Queen. And that's what waiting means, that we're waiting. We're not just doing what we want to do, but we're waiting for instructions. We're waiting on the Lord in that sense. Not my will, but yours be done. It means obedience. But it means trust, doesn't it? It means trust, too. That's what waiting means. Your schedule, not my schedule. Your way, not my way. You can't do that unless your trust is in somebody, absolutely. And that's what God requires. If we're to be on this road to heaven, if we're to walk on His highway that He has built, we've got to trust Him, absolutely. And that's why the Bible makes very clear, it's no good just to believe in that Jesus exists, or just believe that Jesus came from heaven to earth. It's not enough just to believe that occurred. Actually, what the Bible says is we've got to trust Him. Because if we don't trust Him, we'll never go on the road. And the point is, the road only goes to one place. All of our eggs are in that basket. And if we've kind of got our eggs in lots of different baskets, and we're kind of, well, we're trusted in God a little bit, but we're also trusted in our own good works, that'll be enough to get to heaven. And we're trusted in the fact that we're born in a Christian country and we've been baptized and so on as well. And hopefully these things will come together and that will get me into heaven. We're not on the road. Because what we're doing there is we're walking man-made roads. But man-made roads won't go through the mountains. Man-made roads won't get across the valleys. You've got to be on God's road. And God's road is only the person of Jesus Christ as He came from heaven to earth. You can't hedge your bets. You can't put your eggs in different baskets. Wait means trust. And finally, wait also means hope, doesn't it? When you're waiting for something, we wait with eager expectation. That's where our hope is. That's where our heart is. That's what we're longing for. That's what we're looking for. We're longing for glory. We're looking for glory. I wonder, are these things true of you? There's no way that you can get to heaven on your own. There's no way that you can build your own road. But the glory of the gospel message, it was a future prophecy for Isaiah. It's a past fact for us. That God has built His highway. That Jesus Christ has walked that road. And as He goes back, as it were, are you with Him? Walking the road in His strength, waiting on Him. What a tragedy it would be if, having built that road, that highway, we were to go off on our little man-made track and wander away from God, away from sins forgiven, away from peace, away from Jesus, away from an eternity with Him. What a tragedy. Don't let that happen to you.